Some real ups and downs today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. There is nothing like the thrill of a good roller coaster.
420 feet tall, that goes 0 to 120 miles per hour in under 4 seconds.
American companies used to be the best at building coasters, but not anymore. Also today, the alt-right is dominated by white supremacists and white nationalists. Donald Trump's chief strategist has ties to them.
What the alt-right represents has been very much at the margins of American politics. Trump has, in effect, institutionalized it.
And a glimpse inside the billion-dollar global trade in hair.
Throughout Asia, you've got peddlers going door-to-door, collecting really what are globs of hairballs.
The dirty work of hair and more today on The World. Glad you could make it here this Friday, or if you're streaming us in Tokyo this Saturday. Donald Trump announced a couple of new appointments today, including Deputy National Security Advisor. But as far as his senior cabinet members, no news until after this weekend. We want to kick things off today talking about Trump himself. His priority, he says, is to fill national security positions. Trump is, after all, a president-elect who has no meaningful experience on national security issues. So you'd think he'd be cramming on the subject right now and finding people with real-world experience. But what we are hearing is that Trump has not been cramming. In fact, he's barely looked at any of his daily intelligence briefings since he won the vote. Adam Entis has been writing about this for The Washington Post. So he's taken just 2 briefings since the election, Adam. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, as of Thanksgiving Day, he had had 2 briefings on the what's called the President's Daily Brief, which is the intelligence community's most sensitive report on world events. This is something that is prepared every day and is available for President Obama and top advisors to President Obama. And after the election, President-elect Trump and his team is allowed to receive the same briefing. And, you know, a team is ready to come out there and brief him. But so far, Trump has not been available to receive that briefing on a regular basis.
Is there any way to know generally what's contained in these briefings and what Trump has been missing out on?
What it does is it provides a survey of what's going on in hotspots around the world. So one would assume it included recently updates on the Russian campaign in Aleppo, for example, in Syria. One would expect that it would also include things that have not been made public, such as updates on covert action programs around the world.
So let me just give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt for a moment. Are these intelligence briefings digestible by the average person? Like, if you're not a policy wonk and really into this, do you need a PhD to understand what's in them?
Well, you know, President Obama likes to read the book, as they call it. He'll read it from cover to cover. Other presidents have chosen to have briefers. George W. Bush liked to have a presentation made to him. So it really is tailored to the customer, as they say.
Have any current U.S. officials or anyone in the Trump transition team commented on his briefing schedule thus far?
Some of his surrogates and supporters have basically said that the reason why President-elect Trump has not sat down daily to receive the PDB, as it's called, is because he's engaged in trying to fill out his team who will sit in key positions in the cabinet, and that he just hasn't had the time, and that once he's settled on his team, he'll have more time for these briefings.
I gather Vice President-elect Mike Pence has set aside time for these briefings almost every day. What role do you see Vice President Pence playing in national security?
No, and that's not uncommon for presidents-elect to also have other key members of the national security team receive the PDB. That's normal. What it suggests is that Pence is interested in getting this information. It's something that he wants to receive on a regular basis more often than so far Trump has shown an interest in receiving it. Now, it could be that Trump, once he's in office or further along in his transition, will make this a higher priority for himself.
You know, Adam, it's kind of interesting to compare 2 different government executives on security. I think of Bill de Blasio, the New York City mayor, after seeing what happened in Nice this past summer with that truck attack that killed 85 people. De Blasio dispatched trucks loaded with sand to the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade yesterday to block cross streets to prevent such an attack. Maybe it's an unfair comparison. De Blasio is mayor. Trump is not yet president. But do you think if Trump continues not to look at intelligence briefings, I mean, how's he going to learn about the world and how to protect Americans?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question, and we don't really know the answers yet. We don't know what kind of a consumer of intelligence he's going to be once he's closer to taking office. I mean, you know, I know me personally, I mean, I can think of nothing more interesting than this, and that I imagine a president-elect would be very interested in figuring out what the U.S. does around the world. So one would imagine that once he's finished with his team, he'll have more time, and we'll have to wait and see once that happens if he does digest this on a more regular basis.
Adam Entis with The Washington Post, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've probably heard a lot recently about the so-called alt-right. It's a loose grouping dominated by white supremacists and white nationalists. We know some of you listening feel that this movement, if it can be called that, should not get much airtime. And since the election, our own newsroom has been thinking a lot about how to cover it. In this next story, we want to get at why it's important to know about them and the dangers they could pose in the upcoming Trump administration. The World's Maria Muriel has been looking into this.
Last weekend, Richard Spencer led a conference of white nationalists in Washington, D.C. Here they are celebrating President-elect Donald Trump's victory.
Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
Spencer is the leader of the National Policy Institute. It's a small nonprofit focused on, in its own words, white nationalism and the preservation of people of European descent. He's also the person who coined the term alt-right. I reached Spencer by Skype to try to understand what that means.
It's a movement of identity for European Americans living in the 21st century.
Some scholars describe members of the movement another way.
Those are clearly white supremacists.
That's Cass Mutta at the University of Georgia. He studies far-right movements. And Spencer absolutely rejects Mutta's label.
No, a white supremacist is someone who wants to rule over other races. I mean, you want to be supreme above them. That is absolutely not what I want, and that's not what anyone in the alt-right wants.
But judging by their rhetoric, it seems like that is what they want. At his conference, Spencer referred to white people as a race of conquerors and said this country was their inheritance. I told him we were going to call the alt-right white supremacists.
If you guys use that term, then all that means is that every time you talk to us, I'm going to dispute that.
Spencer has been getting a lot of press lately because seeing a group of white men celebrating the election of Donald Trump with Nazi salutes scares people, and news media have jumped on it. But Mutta thinks that's not such a good idea.
If you look at this meeting that was in D.C., last weekend, as far as I can see from the coverage, there were really not that many people. And yet it's covered coast to coast, right? Now, if you do that endlessly, then at a certain point in time, they will get more attention. And more importantly, politicians will start to listen to them because they think that they're important.
Mutta says these people are still fringe, and the news media would do better to focus on the people actually coming into power.
We should look at the ones that really matter, which are people like Steve Bannon. And we should be more aware of intolerant and illiberal views that are actually espoused by people who are in the political mainstream.
Steve Bannon is Trump's chief White House advisor. He has called his news website Breitbart the quote-unquote platform for the alt-right. Lawrence Rosenthal at the Center for Right-Wing Studies is troubled by Bannon's appointment.
In general, what the alt-right represents has been very much at the margins or at the fringes of American politics. Trump has, in effect, institutionalized it. When he brought in Stephen Bannon, he's the first person who presumably Trump turns to say, what's your advice on how I should handle blank?
Recently, Bannon has tried to distance himself from the movement. And this week, the New York Times asked Trump about Spencer's conference, and Trump disavowed the group. But the president-elect flips his position so often, it'll be interesting to see what happens to his campaign promises that appealed to the so-called alt-right. Proposals like a ban on Muslims and the deportation of undocumented immigrants.
To put it in its bluntest form, it suggests what these days goes by the name of ethnic cleansing.
If that sounds extreme, you should know Rosenthal isn't just worried about this new brand of white supremacy influencing the White House. He's also worried about Trump's seemingly authoritarian tendencies.
Not an interview I thought I would be conducting.
I understand that. I understand that. We are in virgin territory here. It's not something we know as Americans.
But he does think the United States is possibly the hardest country for an authoritarian to flourish in, given our system of checks and balances, as long, Rosenthal says, as they can remain intact. For the world, I'm Maria Muriel.
People in France are also worried because the specter of the far right is looming there, too. The incumbent president, socialist François Hollande, is very unpopular. So voters on the left who want to have a say in the presidential election next spring are doing something new. They're going to strategize the victory on the right by voting in the primary for right-wing candidates. Here's Emma Jacobs from Paris.
Penelope Metro took part in a protest last weekend in Paris against American president-elect Donald Trump. I'm a member of the left in my values and my principles, said the 23-year-old student. But the next day, she planned to cross party lines and vote in France's primary for the political right. Kind of like a liberal Democrat voting in a Republican primary.
Le candidat de droite a une très forte chance.
The right's candidate has a very strong chance of becoming president, and I want to have a voice about my preferred candidate, she said. Like the general election in the spring, the primary takes place in two rounds, with a runoff between the top two vote-getters. Of the millions who cast their ballots in round one last Sunday, 15% belong to the political left. Many of them came out to vote against the return of the polarizing former president, Nicolas Sarkozy. And some, like 45-year-old Karine, voted in the primary because they're pessimistic about a left-wing candidate being strong enough to make it to the final runoff. Even though I'm on the left, I have to acknowledge it, Karine says. She asked me not to use her last name to protect the privacy of her vote. She decided to vote strategically for a center-right politician, Alain Juppé, because she felt he was the best positioned to take on the candidate she's really worried about in the general election, Marine Le Pen of the anti-immigrant National Front Party.
Bon, il faut pas se tromper cette fois-ci. Pour faire barrage au Front National,
we can't kid ourselves here. To have a strong candidate to go up against the National Front, we need a very good candidate from the right, she said. In the end, Sarkozy didn't make it into the runoff. His former prime minister, François Fillon, led the pack and will face Juppé in the primary runoff this Sunday. Fillon's victory was a big surprise, and it's left pollsters here scrambling a bit. Sounds familiar, right? But in an election that is much more compressed than the American timeline, a lot can happen, including the emergence of a stronger candidate on the left. On the far right, Marine Le Pen has grown her party's support, especially in the year after the terrorist attacks in Paris and Nice. Still, there's precedent for the left and center-right working together to keep the extreme right from winning. There's the case of Marine Le Pen's own father. On April 21st, 2002, Jean-Marie Le Pen did well enough in the first round to make it to the presidential runoff. Protester Penelope Metro remembers that day. She was just 9 years old. It was my sister's birthday, she recalls. We had just returned from vacation, and then it was a catastrophe. Everyone was calling saying, you need to vote. You need to vote in the runoff. In the end, Le Pen Sr. never expanded beyond his core of far-right voters. He lost overwhelmingly to President Jacques Chirac. But the world has shifted since then. When Le Pen Sr. made it to the runoff, it came as a surprise. This year, French voters expect his daughter to be a leading contender. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It is a billion-dollar-a-year industry that spans the globe. Not software or steel or automobiles. I'm talking about the trade in human hair. And anthropologist Emma Tarlow knows all about it. Her new book is called Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Human Hair. She started by telling me about a third-generation hair trader in India named Kishore Kumar.
He'd actually made his wedding outfit out of human hair, which was Indian hair, bleached and dyed blonde and then decorated with a little red sequins. He also had this idea that he was going to start manufacturing hair for all sorts of different uses, such as fertilizer, for food, for skin products, and cloth. And he was from three generations of hair traders who'd actually started off trading in yak hair, mongoose, and bird feathers back in 1919.
Yeah, did you actually see the wedding outfit that Mr. Kumar made?
I did, yes. He proudly showed me his wedding outfit and a photograph of him sitting in a gold throne wearing it. What is interesting is that human hair has been used for all sorts of uses, particularly in the 1970s and 80s. It was being exported in bulk to places like Korea and Japan for use as interlining in men's suits. And it was supposed to be particularly good for this because it was a little bit stretchy and, on the other hand, it didn't crease. I think this is really a completely sort of unknown element.
It's kind of wild how many people from different corners of the world are involved in some aspect of the hair trade. You travel to Myanmar, and the backstory to this, your interpreter's mother won a lottery and the prize was to become a nun for 9 days. What did that involve?
In Burma, many people hope to pass some of their time in a Buddhist convent or monastery. And in her case, this was a woman who'd never had a haircut in her life. So her hair was sort of down below her hips. Her hair was completely shaved off, and she considered it a great honor.
Tonsure, or head shaving, it's been a ritual of purification for several different religions for centuries, right?
Yes, and it's still very much practiced in South India, in the Hindu temples, where a number of people make vows to the Hindu gods that if something good happens, like a good marriage arrangement or a business thing takes off or someone recovers from an illness, then the whole family will go to the temple as a pilgrimage and they'll all have their heads shaved and then go to worship.
Hair can fetch pretty high prices. What happens to that hair in those tonsure halls?
Yes, well, the hair in the tonsure halls is very carefully looked after. If people have long hair, then it's actually tied up into two bunches before it's shaved off so that the hair is actually kept all in order and it's immediately put in these safes, locked safes. And then it's all transported up to the sorting workshops where it's sorted into very precise lengths. And then about three times a year, it's auctioned off by e-auction to prevent hair cartels and fixing of prices.
Hair cartels?
Yeah. Well, there was a fixing of prices between hair companies. So now it's done by e-auction, so people can't see what other bidders are bidding.
So you also traveled to Qingdao in eastern China, where you met the owner of a company that specializes in wigs and toupees. This man's name is Raymond Tse. He built a factory that makes hair pieces. It now employs 8,000 workers. Describe this factory for us.
Yes. Well, Raymond Chi, in fact, has several factories, so they're not all 8,000 workers in the same one. One of the factories that I went round was particularly interesting. It was specialized in sort of custom-made hair pieces, mainly for people with hair loss in America and Europe and all over the world. The factory receives 500 templates a day, and these are individual head templates that have been measured from people's heads, either using sort of cling film, which is a type of plastic, or something called dermalite, which is a more sort of high-tech material. Along with these templates, they receive incredibly precise details of the exact color, texture, hair density, and shading required for a particular person's hairpiece. And then all these details are translated into Mandarin, and then they're dispersed out around the factory. Raymond Chi claimed that there were something like 120 stages to making a hairpiece. It's a very precise and complex and intricate thing.
How ethically managed are most of these businesses?
Some are quite well managed and others are very clearly badly managed. The very bottom end of the industry, you've got the recuperation of comb waste, which is hair that's fallen from people's heads during brushing and combing and washing. And that is collected up door to door by peddlers. So throughout Asia, you've got peddlers going door to door, collecting really what are globs of hair balls. And these all have to be untangled. And the untangling of this hair takes place in workshops and in people's homes in very poor places where the labor is cheapest. So in parts of Bangladesh, parts of India, and increasingly in Myanmar. So when I was visiting a village in Myanmar, I could see people sorting out these hair balls just with a needle in their village homes. And I met an old lady, she was 83, and she said, "I can't see much, but I make up for it with patience."
Wow.
And when I asked her where this hair was from or where it was going or what it would be used for, she had absolutely no idea. And this was similarly the case with other people there. And when I said to her, "What did you think it was for?" she just said, "Money." And everybody burst out laughing.
Really, though, I mean, how prevalent is that kind of situation? Because what can you possibly make taking old dead hair out of a comb?
because the hair is very long, most people in Myanmar still would never cut their hair. So if you untangle it, sort it, hackle it, resort it, rehackle it, you can get it into absolutely perfect lengths, which can be really quite considerable. And that hair, you know, it looks like the tails of horses kind of thing, beautifully bound. And that hair is all bound up and then it's sent on to the factories in China. And although it's recycled sort of waste hair in some sense, it is used very extensively in the wig industry. What they'll do is they'll drop it into a sort of chemical bath which strips it of its cuticle and so it doesn't tangle so much. And then it's used for wigs and hair extensions.
Wow. So one more character from your book, a man named Benjamin Sherian. He's in India. He's trying to make the hair trade more respectable and raise the standards. How's he doing that?
He'd started off in the late 1970s trading in waste hair for suit interlinings. But nowadays he specializes particularly in temple hair and preparing it for the sort of top end of the market. And yes, he was very keen to improve standards. So he himself had very good labor rights in his factories. He was recycling the water. He'd got all sorts of certification proving that his factory met international standards of trade. But that is quite rare.
So one final use of human hair that will surprise everybody. This is not for the squeamish. Mm-hmm. Human hair can be made into an additive that is a flour enhancer and sometimes is found in pizza, dough, and bagels. Really?
Well, human hair is basically very rich in L-cysteine, which is a type of amino acid, which is particularly good as a flavor enhancer and also for giving elasticity to foods. So it was commonly used in bagels and pizza base, and probably still is to some extent because it's very difficult to trace where L-cysteine comes from. There are certainly factories in China that continue to produce L-cysteine, which they sell into the food industry. But whether the bagel that you ate for breakfast actually contains that, I don't know.
Anthropologist Emma Tarlow, her latest book is called Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Human Hair. Good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. A professor of archaeology and a home baker asks, which came first, the cookie or the cuneiform?
I was trying to remember if I was actually making gingerbread cookies and thought, oh, these look like tablets, or if I was working with tablets and thought, oh, I really am hungry today.
Baking the cuneiform cookie, that's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If Syria is the Mideast tragedy that will soon be Donald Trump's problem, then Yemen is the Mideast tragedy that will continue to be eclipsed by Syria. Tawakkul Karman is from Yemen and won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011, along with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Lema Bowie, both from Liberia. The Nobel Committee recognized all three for their nonviolent struggle for the safety of women and for women's rights to full participation in peace-building work. Karman was also the first Arab woman to ever win the Peace Prize. That was before the war in Yemen began, though. So now, 5 years later, we got a chance to catch up with Karman and hear what she has to say about her country today. So welcome to you, Tawakkul Karman.
Thank you.
It's great to have you back.
Yeah.
So in Yemen, there's a war that's been devastating your people since 2014. There's also a cholera epidemic. Aid is not getting in, so there's a lot of malnutrition. It's a big problem. What have you been hearing from your friends and relatives back in Yemen?
The situation in Yemen is difficult. People need food, people need medicine, people need water, education, health. But Yemeni people still continue their struggle for achieving their great noble values for democracy, for freedom, equality, and peace.
When you received your Peace Prize from the Nobel Committee in 2011, there was not the war that we have now. It's not as if Yemen was without trouble, but you were really honored for your work for women. What has the Nobel Prize done for you in terms of your work trying to bring attention to this war, bring attention to the possibility of peace in Yemen?
The Nobel Prize was as international recognition for my work as a woman and as a youth that represent the will and dreams of the people, of the youth in Arab Spring. So Nobel Prize gives the peaceful revolution itself the recognition from the international community. Now, we need this recognition to continue. We need to keep on the peaceful method that we create in 2011 peaceful revolution. So because of that, we are calling for stop this war. We are calling for ceasefire, immediate ceasefire from all the parties. And also they have to hand over the weapons because we don't want any group to use violence, to use weapons, you know.
You're saying everybody needs to lay down their arms first.
Exactly. And after that, we will go to make referendum for the constitution. We already wrote the draft of constitution. Then we should make the election.
Well, a lot of people feel that the war in Syria has eclipsed a lot of what's going on in Yemen and that Yemen has kind of been forgotten. Do you feel that you've brought enough attention to it? I mean, the Nobel Peace Prize should have brought a lot of attention from the international community on you, on Yemen. And so how have you used that to grab more attention?
Yes, the Nobel Peace Prize should tell all the people, all the international community, all the West, America, to focus on the rights of people in any countries that they are calling for freedom and dignity. I'm calling the international community, I'm calling the United States to do its duty, to do its responsibility on stopping tyranny and stopping terrorism.
There's been a lot of consternation that the United States has been helping Saudi Arabia in their bombing campaign of Yemen, that even some of the munitions have been manufactured here in the United States. We have a new president now, as you know. What is your take on what a Donald Trump presidency will mean for Yemen?
As a woman, I was hoping if Hillary Clinton win the election, but also I believe that America should play a good role on supporting the people. So I hope that Trump, you know, do his rule on implementing the values of America, implementing the values of humanity. Yemeni people want peace. And this peace will not be in Yemen, in Syria, or in any other region if the tyranny is still there.
Tawakkul Karman, do you plan to go back to Yemen? And what do you think your presence would do if you were there to accelerating peace?
Yes, I will return to Yemen, inshallah, very soon. But also, I hope that our initiative, our view on to the sustainable peace to be implemented. And also, we are calling for, again, transitional justice and reconciliation. But also, this reconciliation shouldn't avoid justice. Because when we avoid justice in Yemen, the war happened.
Tawakkul Karman is a co-recipient of the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize. Thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you so much.
But could you achieve transitional justice in Yemen with gingerbread? Not such a weird question when you do what Katie Blanchard does. Katie is in charge of the Near Eastern collections at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. That means she spends a lot of time with ancient clay tablets from early Mesopotamia. One day she came up with an idea. Wouldn't it be fun to bake her own tablets out of gingerbread for the office holiday party? And thus were born the cuneiform cookies. Cuneiform referring to wedge-shaped writing, kind of the next step up in alphabets after hieroglyphics. And the rest, as they say, is history. Katie Blanchard joins me now. So how did this idea come about in the first place, Katie?
I was trying to remember if I was actually making gingerbread cookies and thought, oh, these look like tablets, or if I was working with tablets and thought, oh, I really am hungry today. I think it was the former. I'm pretty sure I was just at home making my gingerbread cookies and thought, this really feels like work, and went ahead and thought about how it really related to something I was working with.
Had you ever kind of tried to build a tablet at the museum or work with old tablets to restore them? Had you had your fingers in the mud, shall we say, before?
Just with them at the museum. So they were already at the museum. They were already baked. Many of them are fragmentary. One of my first days working with the tablets, I was one of those lucky few that was able to make a join. So finding two fragments, and I don't read cuneiform. I want to say that from the beginning. I know enough to know which way is up when I put an object on display. But even I could see that these two signs joined, and I was able to make that join, and it felt really good.
So I gave a fairly blunt description of cuneiform in my introduction. Elaborate, though. What is it, and what does cuneiform look like?
Sure. So cuneiform, you're absolutely right. It just means wedge-shaped, and it's something that grew out of the pictographs of early Mesopotamia. It came around the same time as that early Egyptian writing. So we're talking about 5,000 years ago. And, you know, many languages do this. Our letter A is the same as the Phoenician symbol for ox. So this is something that happens through a lot of different cultures. And people would sit there and they would write their words, and the shorthand is what caught on. So the messier it looked, the men it didn't pass on. And so you just end up with these letters, these words, these signs that come out of those early pictographs.
So what kind of things get written on the cookies?
I'm very basic. So mine say things very simple, like the word for God or the word for build, which were actually the two of the first signs that I learned because I was working with a set of bricks and I wanted to know which way was up. And every brick that has a stamp is stamped with a wonderful inscription about the fact that a king built this building for a god. So by learning king, god, and build, I knew how to orient, you know, all 300 bricks in our collection.
Wow.
So I didn't really learn beyond that.
Right.
But I've done some research, and I've branched out, and I include the word for sun and the word for bird. Very simple things is what I'm capable of doing.
So a quick question about technique and cooking. How do you make these inscriptions in the dough without the dough losing its imprint?
I'm trained as a classical archaeologist, so I'm going to use the phrase leather hard stage as if we're talking about Attic pottery.
Okay.
I started the first batch I did, I tried them at the beginning, and then I realized that you're absolutely right. You lose that impression as you go through it. And so I took them out mid-baking. So if my recipe takes 12 minutes, I take it out at 6 minutes, and then I make my impressions at that moment and then put it back in. Because if you do it at the end, you're really just breaking through good cookie.
Is it true there's now a cuneiform cookie craze?
I am surprised to say, maybe I shouldn't be surprised. Maybe everybody really loves something ancient in their kitchen during the holidays. But yes, there have been a lot of people who have done so many amazing things with the simple idea that I had put out.
You also made something called a brownie ziggurat. What is that? Doesn't sound like it could adapt in a ceramics class.
No, that is very true. I am a great lover of bricks, and I bought like a special cookie pan or a special brownie pan, so they were all tiny little squares, and I tried three different brownie recipes to make sure they all came out very flat, and I built them up like a ziggurat, which is very similar. And the brownies were my bricks, and I took it to the holiday party hoping to win once again, you know, most creative, and I lost spectacularly to someone who made an amazing Mayan temple out of yellow cake with so much icing. It was beautiful, and no one wanted to even cut into it.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, when the Mayan temple comes in the room, it's going to really hard to fight that one. What's next on your archaeo culinary list?
I've actually recently been thinking, as I had said, I have a classical training, and I've always been really interested in the Forma Urbis, which is the large Severan marble plan of the city of Rome, and I was hoping to maybe do something this year. Don't tell anybody at work, but I'm really hoping to bring it out for the holiday party this year. I was going to do some form of shortbread or sugar cookie Forma Urbis.
That sounds pretty epic. I hope nobody shows up with a Mayan temple.
I do too. I mean, the Mayan temple was beautiful and well-deserved to win.
I think ancient Rome will win. Katie Blanchard with the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. She's behind the cuneiform cookie craze. Katie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We've talked a lot this year about manufacturing going overseas. The presidential candidates did a lot, too. Here's another instance. This time, it's about roller coasters. The world's Jason Margolis has our story.
In the 1950s, Walt Disney wanted to build something the world had never seen, a roller coaster using tubular steel track that allowed for more twists and turns. He turned to a local California company to build the Matterhorn bobsleds, an iconic ride still today. These days, the roller coaster business operates quite differently. Each year, amusement park operators congregate for a week in Orlando at the annual trade show expo for IAPA. That's short for the International Association of Amusement Parks and Attractions. Park executives stroll the floor inspecting everything from a 16-foot gumball machine.
It's got a big handle. It makes a lot of noise.
To stuffed animals, games of chance, and the latest flavors of fudge. And of course, park operators meet with engineers who build roller coasters too.
When we go to a company, we really just say longest, tallest, fastest, or something that no one's ever done.
Rob Decker is with Cedar Fair Entertainment, which owns 11 parks in North America. Their park, Cedar Point, in Sandusky, Ohio, is known for pushing the extremes. They built the first coaster over 200 feet high in 1989. 11 years later, they topped 300 feet.
And once you hit 300, 400 is on the horizon. So we built Top Thrill Dragster in 2003. 420 feet tall, a launch coaster that goes 0 to 120 miles per hour in under 4 seconds.
That's like racing up a 40-story building, then plunging straight back down. For their biggest, baddest rides, Cedar Fair has turned to Swiss and German manufacturers. I heard this from a lot of park operators.
They were willing to take a chance to build something that had world domination, world record scale, and not feel like they had to repeat that ride and duplicate that somewhere else to make their commercial enterprise, you know, viable for them.
The only roller coaster designer that's topped 400 feet, and they've done it 3 times, is Swiss-based Intamin. Company president Sandro Kernex was at their booth. I asked how they and other Swiss-German companies came to dominate.
Well, basically, there is a long history in Germany of building amusement rides and also precision engineering design.
What's your highest one?
The highest one, I believe, is 457 feet.
That is really high. How high can you build? What is the limit?
Well, there is actually no limit. It is basically everything depends on the ride experience and also the cost.
Big roller coasters typically cost $25 to $35 million. American builders used to rule this market. But when it comes to the premier marquee steel coasters, the ones you look at and say, no way I'm getting on that, Switzerland and Germany have been on top for about 20 years.
It really comes down to, you know, German and Swiss engineering. That's terrible. I should not do foreign accents.
I think his accent is pretty good. Martin Lewison is an assistant professor of business management at Farmingdale State College in New York, where he studies the amusement park industry.
I've ridden 1,478 roller coasters.
Besides top engineering, Lewison says the Swiss-German manufacturers have also built better business models. Historically, they've been more diversified, selling other products from ski lifts to agricultural machinery.
It's a tough business, so these companies come into and go out of existence with sort of disheartening regularity.
So during tough economic times when amusement parks hold back on big purchases, it helps to have other products to sell too. One company that understands this is Mack Rides in Germany. Maximilian Rusa heads marketing for the company.
The Mack company is now 236 years old, so we opened up our business in 1780.
Well, surely you weren't making roller coasters back then, right?
No, not really. We came from the manufacturing of carts, mainly for bringing the wood from the Black Forest down to the Rhine River.
From there, they moved on to carnival rides and eventually the big steel coasters. But in this business, you're only as good as your latest creation. Mack is now looking to virtual reality. Every ride is different, a journey through the desert, the mountains, wherever.
Each and every passenger gets a goggle. It's synchronized with the roller coaster, so you won't get motion sickness because your brain is feeling on the same as you're seeing, and therefore you won't get motion sick on these rides.
Are you sure?
Totally sure.
If he's right, the Swiss Germans could enjoy many more years on top. For The World, Jason Margolis, Orlando.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We reported not so long ago about cruise ships plying through the waters of the Arctic Ocean, now that lots of icebergs have melted and no longer pose a threat to the boats. That's one of the very few positive signs of ice melt due to global warming. But ice is melting at such an unprecedented rate that we could actually push past a number of tipping points that would be irreversible and have huge impacts on life across the planet. That's what a newly released study tells us. It's the Arctic Resilience Report, and it's the work of 6 universities, the Arctic Council, and 11 research organizations. Fiona Harvey is The Guardian's environment correspondent, and she's been looking at the report. What tipping points is the report referring to, Fiona?
The report records at least 19 potential tipping points, and some of these are very serious for the whole of the world, not just the Arctic. For instance, the melting of sea ice in the Arctic actually contributes to warming in itself. So what happens is that you've got the ice cap, which at the moment reflects a lot of the heat back out to space. The heat of the sun is reflected back out to space because of the snow and the ice. And when that snow and ice cover disappears, what happens is that the sea surrounding the ice cap is darker than the snow and ice, and so it absorbs heat. So you get this sort of feedback mechanism whereby the darker sea absorbs more heat, and that melts more ice, and in turn that creates more dark sea, which melts more ice, and so on in a spiral. This has the potential to create a runaway form of global warming that it will be very, very difficult to stop.
It sounds like what you're saying is ice melt actually accelerates climate change. And it does it go at an exponential rate at that point? I mean, how fast is the rate of change at the moment in the Arctic?
Some of these things are unknowable because we haven't been in this situation before in the entire experience of human civilization. In the Arctic at the moment, temperatures are about 20 degrees above where they would normally be at this time of year. And if you think about it, 20 degrees is huge.
So a change of 20 degrees Celsius, that's over 50 degrees Fahrenheit. That's extraordinary.
That's not just a minor fluctuation. That's not within the bounds of what is normal variation from year to year. That is what scientists have been calling to us, way off the charts. It's simply out of our experience. We need to understand that the problem is going ever more urgent.
Fiona, we keep getting reports like this one from any number of respected research organizations that say the same thing. Things are or will be irreversible. Humans are responsible for this. How many more reports have to come out before people actually feel the urgency?
I'd love to know. There are good signs at the moment, however. We have reasons to be cheerful. For a start, the rate at which we are pouring greenhouse gases into the atmosphere appears to have stabilized for the past 3 years. So the amount of carbon that we put into the atmosphere last year was the same as the year before and the year before that. That is significant because hopefully what it means is that our carbon release, our carbon production into the atmosphere is leveling off. And that needs to happen as soon as possible so that then we can bring down the amount of carbon that we release into the atmosphere each year.
Fiona Harvey, the Guardian's environment correspondent. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
So ice melt in the Arctic, but in Vermont, it's an icy buildup they're looking for, and they got it. Because when you are talking about the World Cup of alpine skiing, you want an icy, fast surface. The World Cup ski circuit is where the top alpine racers from around the globe compete, places like Val d'Isère in France and Lake Louise in Canada. But tomorrow and Sunday, for the first time in nearly 40 years, the World Cup returns to the Killington Ski Resort in Vermont. The races will feature the top women skiers like Julia Mancuso and Michaela Schifrin. Lindsey Vonn is out with a broken arm. Nathaniel Vinton is a former ski racer and the author of The Fall Line, America's Rise to Ski Racing Summit. So, Nathaniel, how big a deal is it that a World Cup ski event is happening again in Killington?
It's a very big deal for the people of New England who follow this sport, which is a substantial crowd. There's a very deep roots for ski racing in New England. That's where the sport was really born as far as the United States goes.
Is there a kind of climate change, global warming component to how they schedule the World Cup ski races?
You know, the ski racers they're used to bad weather and races getting canceled. You know, there's evidence that the winter season is shortening in the Alps where the sport is normally staged. And for a long time, they've been looking for reliable snow. And for a long time, that's been Beaver Creek, Colorado, a very high altitude Rocky Mountain area. And the FIS, which organizes the World Cup, was happy to put races in a venue that had such dependable snow in November and December. It turns out this year that's not the case. Beaver Creek's races got canceled because it's so warm in the Rockies this year. So it's a good thing that the World Cup came to Vermont this year.
And I gather they've got some decent snow in Killington?
Yeah, I'm watching it pile up right now here in Vermont. There's fresh snow, which is not always welcome for the World Cup racers. They like an icy surface. And Killington has prepared that for the women's races this weekend. So they'll scrape off all the new snow so they can get down to the sort of hockey rink kind of surface.
This would seem to be a big moment for U.S. World Cup skiing. I mean, the team has some top-ranked racers like Michaela Schifrin. It's back in the U.S. this year in Killington. And yet for Europe, it's being broadcast live. But here in the U.S., NBC is only showing the second races of each event.
Well, in Europe, there's a different fan base for the sport. People are accustomed to watching an entire race, and NBC likes to take the entire natural tension of the ski race and demolish it and put it back together as a showdown between a couple racers that they can build a story around, which is an effective way for them, they've proven over the years, to broadcast ski racing.
So tell us about cowbells, because I don't know if you've seen the ad, but Killington is running TV spots with the old Saturday Night Live line, "More cowbell." It's got a different meaning when it comes to skiing. Yeah, that's the ad. It's in the offices of the Killington Ski Resort, and they're all about the cowbell, bringing that great Swiss tradition here. You taking any cowbells, Nate?
I hadn't thought to yet. I'm bringing some toddlers, so that'll do the trick. They'll make some noise.
Nathaniel Vinton, the author of The Fall Line, America's Rise to Ski Racing Summit. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. It was a pleasure.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell.
Yeah, you knew we were going there. Our theme music was composed by Eric Les Cowbell Goldberg. We come to you from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, wishing you a very pleasant weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.